École normale supérieure, savoir en multimédia.
It's a pleasure to be back, particularly after such a beautiful weekend. Sunday was incredible. I will begin by talking a little bit about what we discussed last time, just to refresh your memory. So before you are two of the images we looked at this time, the portrait of Frederick Douglass on the left and a Kodak image from around 1890 on the right, just to remind you of our discussion of the enthusiasm for photography in a nation ostensibly founded on principles of liberty and equality, a nation that was embracing commercial ingenuity and innovation, a country that lacked a rich Western cultural history and pictorial tradition, and a country that exalted the notion of the self-made man. Yeah? Very much a gendered notion, but the self-made man. For all these reasons, photography found particularly fertile soil in the United States, and enthusiasm for the medium was intense and immediate. We also discussed last time the reputation that photography established in the latter part of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th for revealing what was otherwise invisible in the world. It did this most spectacularly in the case of motion photography and X-ray photography, where things that had never before been seen were revealed by the camera. But this gave photography a general reputation for having a particularly insightful and penetrating gaze on the world. And this reputation extended into the social realm in the 1890s and in the early 20th century, when photographers such as Jacob Riis, whose photograph you see here on the right, alongside Edward Muybridge's motion study of a horse galloping, when photographers such as Jacob Riis and Lewis Hine began making photographs of the working class, of the slums, of the tenements in New York City and elsewhere in the eastern United States, these photographs gradually developed within photojournalism this reputation of photography as a means of revealing social conditions that were otherwise unseen. Yeah? So this notion that photography revealed worlds about which we were otherwise unconscious had a broad range extending from the sciences to social reportage. And then we discussed last time the emergence of serious efforts at making photography into an art form, which, as I mentioned last time, in the United States came more slowly than they did in France or Germany, for example. And they really got going in the latter part of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th, led by the efforts of Alfred Stieglitz, whom we discussed rather extensively last time. You have two Stieglitz photographs before you that I showed last time. On the left, one of the portraits of Georgia O'Keeffe, and on the right, one of Stieglitz's equivalents, his cloud photographs. You will recall that Stieglitz was really a transatlantic figure, one who embraced both European culture and American culture, and to a certain extent sought a synthesis of the best of both sides of the Atlantic. And he pushed photography toward abstraction in a way that I think has only really been appreciated in recent years, beginning with a landmark essay by Rosalind Krauss on the equivalence. And photographs such as the one on the right in that series, and we talked about last time the way in which these photographs confused day and night. They were disorienting, bodily, you could not relate to the world depicted in the same way that you could in typical photography. Such photographs really disabled or undid the easy realism of photography to which people had become accustomed. And they were remarkable efforts at pushing photography towards abstraction, but always there was lurking in the background the notion of embodiment, right? These two photographs I juxtapose not arbitrarily. That is to say, Stieglitz went from the portraits of O'Keeffe to the equivalents historically in short order. And it is one of the problems within American photography, studies of American photography of this era, to think about what kinds of embodiment still linger in photographs such as the one on the right. Now, this was a story that I told last time quite swiftly, and I only want to remark parenthetically, with two images that I did not show last time, I want to remark that obviously there are many other important practitioners in this moment that we are not discussing at any length. And I give you just two examples. This is a Gertrude Casimir here on the left, her pastoral of 1905. Casimir was a prominent pictorialist, and she favored the bichromate gum print, which allowed her to work the surface of the image in a way that ostensibly brought photography closer to drawing or printmaking or other graphic art forms. And on the right, a very important early modernist in American photography named Paul Strand. This is his White Fence of 1916. Strand was a colleague and friend of Alfred Stieglitz's, but there was also considerable competition between the two men. Strand produced a tremendous set of photographs between 1915 and 1916 that very much inspired Stieglitz and also challenged him. You can see here the beginnings of a kind of reflexive play of surface between what is depicted in the photograph and the surface of the photograph itself. And this is something that Strand was very interested in. With Strand, we get a new degree of a kind of reflexive intelligence, thinking about what a photograph is and how one could represent what a photograph is in a photograph, given that photography was thought to be so directed out to the world. Today, I want to discuss the next moment in American photography, focusing on the 1930s and 1940s. And there's three developments during this period that I want to emphasize. The first has to do with the institutionalization of photography as an art medium. In 1937, Beaumont Newhall, who's an important figure in American photography, and who was then in charge of the photography department at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, put together a very large show, and I'm showing you the cover of the catalog here on the left. It was called Photography 1839 to 1937, kind of interesting, a 98-year retrospective instead of a full century. I guess he didn't want to wait. But it was a show that in many ways attempted to give a kind of comprehensive history of photography within the Museum of Modern Art. The exhibition filled four floors of the museum with over 800 examples of photographs from a range of categories and technological moments and cultural domains, including meteorological photographs, microphotography, journalistic photography, daguerreotypes, new color processes. So It was a very broad exhibition, and it was an exhibition that was very much informed by European precedents, particularly French precedents, and also the film and photo show that had been at Stuttgart. So this was another case of a transatlantic cross-fertilization here, bringing the idea of a photographic history into the museum, which was quite new. At the same time, there was a fellow named Robert Taft, who was a chemist at the University of Kansas, who wrote an important history called Photography in the American Scene, much more of a social history than the one that Newhall produced. Whereas Taft's history tended to fade over time, although it continues to be printed, so some people are reading it, Newhall, after he did this catalog, produced a book based upon it called The History of Photography, and you see a cover of one edition on the right. This book came out in several editions and became the standard text in courses on the history of photography in the United States for several decades. So Newhall was an exceedingly important figure. This moment in 1937, when this exhibition goes up at the Museum of Modern Art, represents a shift away from Stieglitz as the person who was bringing photography to the New York art public to the Museum of Modern Art, which then becomes the most important venue for exhibitions of photography from then on. So photography has entered the art museum, but it has entered it in a very peculiar way. It's very interesting that the first major exhibition of photography at the Museum of Modern Art was not just art photography, but photography of all these different categories. And this reflects the difficulty that people had of coming to terms with what exactly photography was, what the boundaries were between aesthetic value in a photograph and other kinds of values, including instrumental values. And this has been a problem that has persisted over time. One of the functions of that exhibition was to create what was then called, in the 1930s in America, a usable past. This was a popular phrase. And it suggested that modernization in the United States was making it difficult to establish the kinds of traditions, the kinds of historical precedents that had once been enjoyed, and so that the past required a more active kind of construction. And one of the things that Newhall did in his exhibition was to create a past for contemporary art photographers in the 1930s. And so, for example, one of the practitioners who worked closely with Newhall on putting together this show was the photographer Ansel Adams, who was a landscape photographer. We'll talk a bit more about him later on. But one of the purposes of Newhall's show was to give practitioners such as Ansel Adams a usable past, to give them precursors, to give them a history which would justify their art, but also give them a kind of legacy, a kind of set of challenges, and so forth. And so last time, we looked at this photograph on the left by Timothy O'Sullivan, this photograph of the ancient ruins in the Canyon de Chelly, taken in 1873. And this photograph was in the exhibition in 1937 as an example of early American photography. But it was there not only as a kind of historical relic, but also as a way to suggest that modernism in photography had been anticipated by these early practitioners. And I show you on the right a photograph that Ansel Adams made not long after the exhibition of the same site. And it's not easy to get to. So Ansel Adams had to go out of his way to go to the Canyon de Chelly and make this photograph, which is both an homage to O'Sullivan's earlier photograph, but also a way of testing his mettle, as we say in English. That is, giving himself a challenge to see if he could make his own version that lived up to the precedent of O'Sullivan. For American painters in the 19th century, Niagara Falls was the subject that people painted to test themselves against those who came before them and to test themselves against their peers. And the Canyon de Chelly became that in photography. Another important American photographer, Elliot Porter, came and took his own photograph of the same site, and others did as well. So this institutionalization of photography, this creation of a photographic history, this bringing of photography into the art museum is one of the important developments of the 1930s. A second very important development of the 1930s has to do with photography as a socially concerned medium. And we saw the early history of this last time in the work of Jacob Riis and Lewis Hine. And this kind of work gains great prominence in the 1930s as a result of government patronage. And this photograph before you is by Russell Lee. It's called Farm Security Administration, Clients at Home, Hildego County, Texas, and it's from 1939. So this requires a little background history. During the Great Depression, tensions surrounding the social contract in the United States in this rapidly modernizing economy, but also an economy that proved to be very susceptible to breakage. Tensions surrounding the social contract during this moment came to the breaking point. Yeah? The litany of economic problems is impressive and perhaps familiar to you. Obviously, it was a global phenomenon. But in the United States, there were bank failures, farm foreclosures, a 40% drop in productivity per worker. Extraordinary, 40% drop in productivity per worker, an unemployment rate over 25%. And the persistence of these economic problems through the early 1930s led to the election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the embrace of his New Deal. Yeah? And the New Deal, of course, was, in a sense, a new social contract. One of the great legal historians in the United States, a fellow named Bruce Ackerman, has identified three constitutional moments in American history. That is to say, three moments in which the social contract, the contract that essentially defines America as a nation, was written. The first moment was the original writing of the Constitution and its acceptance by the states, its ratification. The second moment was Reconstruction after the Civil War, when the North and the South had to establish new terms based on the North's victory for what the nation was, how far the rights of equality and liberty extended, and so forth. And the third moment was the New Deal. So for Ackerman, this was a third moment in which the social contract had to be reconstructed. And one of the things that Ackerman talks about is how the original Constitution was flexible enough to actually be reinterpreted so radically in three different moments. So the New Deal, as you may know, radically revised the social contract insofar as it started to guarantee a certain kind of security against these economic fluctuations. The idea was that every citizen, by participating in the economy, was entitled to certain protections and guarantees. As you may know, in the United States, that runs against a very strong strain of ideology, which is based on the individual and thinks that the individual should rise and fall based on their own efforts, et cetera. So Roosevelt's reforms were highly controversial. And of course, we're living through this in the United States once again with Obama and his health care legislation, where there's a lot of concern among certain people that this is socialism, which is un-American, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the moment where this issue was at its most intense was in the 1930s with the New Deal. And it takes historical imagination to think our way back to a time when the social contract was so vivid and considered so open to renegotiation, right? One of the great disappointments of the political left after 1968 was the realization that evidently the social contract was not open to this kind of renegotiation any longer. And it's remarkable for Americans to read back to the court cases from the 1920s and 1930s and to see, for example, Supreme Court justices such as Louis Brandeis refer to the corporation as a Frankenstein monster created by legislation. It's quite remarkable. It is one of those instances of historical estrangement that makes the study of history so interesting. So Roosevelt, in creating reforms that gave greater security to people against these kinds of economic fluctuations, and in particular, security against the disruptions that his own programs were causing, turned to photography as a way to convince people that the New Deal was a good shift in policy. And one of Roosevelt's particular problems had to do with the rural poor. And the reason this was a problem is that Roosevelt responded to a depression in farm prices for agricultural goods, by paying farmers to not grow crops on certain fields, to artificially limit supply. What this meant was that certain tenant farmers and farm workers were made unemployed. And with an unemployment rate already at 25%, this was a big political problem. And so he created something called the Resettlement Administration in 1935, the Resettlement Administration, which was later renamed in 1937 the Farm Security Administration, to support these displaced farm workers and tenant farmers so that they could be retrained and get other jobs so forth. And Rexford Tugwell, who had been a Columbia economics professor, was put in charge of this program. And his colleague, actually it was his teaching assistant, Roy Stryker, was put in charge of the photography program for the Farm Security Administration. And Stryker, who was quite a brilliant manager, proceeded to hire an extraordinary set of photographers, including Russell Lee, whose photograph you see here, as well as Dorothea Lange, Walker Evans, Ben Shahn, Arthur Rothstein, Jack Delano, and Gordon Parks. And if you're a student of American photography, these names are quite familiar. Now, this photograph before you is quite a characteristic FSA photograph by Lee. On the one hand, there are indications in it of poverty and financial need. Maybe difficult to see in the back, but for example, there's a gaping hole in the sock of the gentleman here on the left. Their shoes are damaged and very worn. In general, it looks like they're living close to the bone, as we sometimes say in the United States. So you have these suggestions of need, but you also have suggestions that they are deserving poor, right? This was one of the struggles in the United States, was to demonstrate that the poor were deserving, because there was a lingering social Darwinism that said that if you're poor, it's because you haven't worked hard enough, you haven't had the proper virtues, and you deserve what you get. In this case, though, this phrase deserving poor meant deserving our sympathy and deserving our support. We see that they are literate. He's reading, right? He's taking part in what had become a kind of civic ritual of reading magazines and newspapers to stay abreast of current events. Between the two of them is a large radio, which was a sign of social commonality in the 1930s. Roosevelt was famous for his fireside chats, which were speeches given over the radio. The radio was becoming a kind of glue to hold the country together through difficult times. They seem cultured. There's some kind of reproduction up above of a tapestry of an 18th century chamber concert, right? So although they're poor, they seem cultured. The woman is depicted as industrious, right? She's knitting or mending something in her lap, right? So all these signs are very deliberate, right? This is the production of an image of the rural poor that suggests that although they are in need of support, that they are leading a difficult life, they are also virtuous, they are taking part in the social community, and that they have their own culture. Here's a Dorothea Lange photograph from 1935. It's called All We Got to Start With. It's not grammatical, it's in the kind of vernacular. All We Got to Start With is a family of kids, is the way that this is titled. And Dorothea Lange was a master at representing these poor rural subjects in ways that called up the great pictorial precedents of the past, particularly the Madonna and Child, the Holy Family. Her images are very redolent of these precedents. Once again, you see a kind of resourcefulness. She's using a Coke bottle with an attachment on it as a kind of milk bottle for the child, right? Which serves a double purpose, because it demonstrates that they're very resourceful and they're poor and they're struggling. But also, the Coke bottle is, of course, a sign of Americanness, yeah, and that common Americanness to excuse me, didn't mean to do that. That linked the viewers of these images with the subjects represented within them. And similarly, the Caro sugar in the upper right, these signs of commerce were used quite a bit in the Farm Security Administration photographs. There's no indication that they were being paid for this, that these were product placements. Instead, I think these commercial signs were beginning to be used to try to knit together a common culture using the logos of modern commerce. Now, Stryker was an extremely effective public relations specialist. Not only did he assemble a superb team of photographers, but he established a powerful network of connections to media outlets, to newspapers and magazines and museums, to ensure that these photographs reached a vast audience. In his first 2 years in his position, Stryker produced 23 exhibitions of FSA photographs, One was at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Another was at the Democratic National Convention. So he was extraordinarily effective at getting these photographs before the public. By the end of 1938, photographs such as this one had appeared in Time magazine, Fortune magazine, Look magazine, Life magazine, the New York Times, and many other magazines and newspapers. And there were books also published by the Farm Security Administration. Over a dozen books were published. Now, many of these photographs, if you go to find them in the Library of Congress, are on these cards. There was a filing system. There was an archive at the Farm Security Administration. So this is another Dorothea Lange photograph called West Staten, Marion County, Oregon, August 1939. In the files, the photographs generally have titles just of place and date. And then when they were used in the press, they would often get these other titles, such as All We Got to Start With is a Family of Kids. The archive was very large. Between 1935 and 1943, Stryker's photographers amassed over 270,000 prints and negatives to justify these programs. And many of them, as this one, used children. Children were a very important sign in these photographs, a sign for a number of things. Innocence, yeah? So even if you thought that the poor adults had somehow created their own fate, it was hard to argue that the children had done so, right? So it tended to defeat the social Darwinism that was still prevalent, right? Children also serve to suggest that this will be an ongoing problem unless it is corrected, right? It suggests a kind of continuity that requires these changes in order to interrupt the problem. This is a Marion Post Walcott from Mosquito Crossing. It's a wonderful name of a place. Mosquito Crossing in Georgia from 1939. It's another picture in which demonstrates this effort to define a kind of Americanness to these poor, to suggest that the obligation of the middle and upper class in the United States to these individuals had to do with a common national bond. Right, and it is interesting the extent to which it was the commercial sign, the commercial logo, that becomes that sign for a nationalist unity. Yeah, we are one under Coca-Cola. Right, and this is a remarkable and lasting ideology. Right, I mean, there's a wonderful quotation from Andy Warhol, the pop artist in the 1960s, in which Warhol says, quote, "You can be watching TV and see Coca-Cola, and you can know that the president drinks Coke. Liz Taylor drinks Coke. And just think, you can drink Coke too." Yeah? So this notion that what could signify the commonality, the unity of the citizenry of the United States, and the egalitarian principle of the United States was in fact something like Coca-Cola is quite remarkable. And so Stryker understood this long before Andy Warhol did and had his photographers use these signs. Dorothea Lange was one of Stryker's most effective photographers. And as I mentioned, she mastered the capacity to bring these photographs into line with the great Western pictorial tradition, right? So her most famous photograph from the Depression era clearly invokes, yeah, the Madonna and Child, or the Madonna and Child and St. John, right? And the nobility, the sense of noble suffering on the face of this woman, the sense that the children are turned away in shame, yeah? That they won't face the camera because they are so uncomfortable with their condition, made this a particularly powerful photograph, which became an icon in American photography. And you can go on the web and find all sorts of instances in which it is still used today. So for example, this is from the last few years. This was a demonstration against layoffs. It says, "Save our jobs," and you can see that that image is continues to be reproduced as a way to invoke a particular kind of social contract where those who participate in the American dream are entitled to a certain kind of support when that dream falls short. Many of these photographers were very well educated in the history of Western art and drew upon its precedents in many different ways, not just with respect to the Madonna and Child, but also other precedents. So here, for example, you have another Dorothea Lange of Filipino lettuce cutters from 1935, clearly working off French realism, you know, of Millet, the gleaners of 1857 here on the right. So there was this mining of historical precedent, but there was, at the same time, right here being mined to give the rural laborer a kind of heroic status, there was at the same time a look forward. That is to say that even as they produced these photographs that had a very strong social function, a governmental function, photographers such as Dorothea Lange also at certain moments created photographs that seemed very modernist, that very much took up this interest in abstract forms in the world. And so this abandoned farmhouse in Texas from 1938, she represents in a way that really stresses its formal qualities. Another thing that Lange was very good at, and some of the other FSA photographs were also good at, was using various parts of the body to convey social conditions. Yeah? And so, whereas Alfred Stieglitz, as we saw, used a kind of analytic view of the human body to push photography towards abstraction, to create a kind of serial portraiture that was of particularly modernist ambition, Lange used the hands, for example, to show us the history of work, of labor, of effort of this subject, and also to give it a kind of monumentality as though it's a kind of classical fragment, and also to give it a kind of universality by not showing us the face, right? Not showing us precisely that part of the body that conveys individuality. These hands take on a kind of universal significance as though they were the hands of the farm worker in America in the 1930s. And there's, you know, there's a quite an impressive use of synecdoche here to give us the part of the body standing in for the whole, standing in for its effort, standing in for its suffering. And the art historian Sally Stein, who's one of the best photography historians in the United States, has made the argument that Lange may have been particularly drawn to this kind of bodily expressiveness because she was partially crippled by polio as a child, right? And so Stein argues that this may have sensitized Lange to this this expressiveness. Certainly she was the best among the FSA photographers at this kind of work. In 1939, Lange and a fellow named Paul Taylor come out with a book called American Exodus, A Record of Human Erosion. Right? Interesting metaphor. Yeah? That as the Dust Bowl, as the drought in the middle part of the country was hurting farmers that the erosion was not just a matter of the soil, but actually human beings. And of course, the notion of human erosion suggests that what is happening to these farm workers and farmers is beyond their control. Like a geological process, it is something that simply happens. Yeah? And this was something that the government was trying to convey, that in the modern economy, certain things just happen, right, and are not the result of someone falling short in the virtues of industry or self-reliance. In these books and in the magazines, of course, these images, which I tend to be showing you singly, appear in multiples and they appear with text. And the relationship between image and text is exceedingly important. And sometimes the text is changed in a way that radically changes the meaning of the image. So, for example, with respect to this photograph right here of this figure shown from below, giving her a kind of heroic stature with her hand clasped to her head, indicating her despair at her condition. With respect to this picture, when she was in the field, Dorothea Lange, who made the photograph, wrote in her logbook, she's writing a quotation from one of the subjects of these photographs. "They won't help bury you here. If you die, you're dead. That's all." Right? That's what she wrote in her logbook. In the book on human an American Exodus, A Record of Human Erosion, the caption becomes, "If you die, you're dead, that's all." So what's been removed is the part of the quotation that said, "They won't help bury you here." Yeah? Which is a very different meaning. What she wrote down in the logbook is that people don't care enough about you to even bury you here, right? It's a kind of indifference, yeah? But what it comes out as, if you die, you're dead, that's all, it's a kind of existential statement, yeah? Radically different meaning, one having to do with a kind of lack of social caring, the other having to do with just the existential fact of, if you die, you're dead, that's all, right? And this kind of manipulation went on a great deal in Stryker's office. And sometimes the photographers became very frustrated because they would have found one thing when they were out making the picture, and then it would be transformed by the way that the photographs were arranged or by the text that went with the photographs in order to make the government message clear, to keep the photography on message, as they say today. One of the photographers that worked for Stryker, the one that became the best known, is Walker Evans. And this is a photograph he made before he worked for Stryker called Roadside Sign in 1929. Evans dropped out of college in the late 20s, and he went to Paris for a year, which is what you do at that time if you were someone of aesthetic ambition, yeah? And he wrote short stories and he made photographs. And he gradually became very ambitious as a photographer. And when he began working for Stryker, he did so less because he was committed to what was essentially a propaganda program of the Roosevelt administration, and instead because he wanted the government support to go out and make his own photographs in the rural United States. And it wasn't long before the friction between Stryker and Evans got so bad that Evans left the government program. And he later referred to these photographs that he made as documentary style instead of documentary. Now, very different, documentary style rather than documentary. He became well known fairly rapidly. In 1938, he came out with a book called American Photographs that accompanied an exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art. It was the first show at the Museum of Modern Art dedicated to a single photographer. So this is just a year after Beaumont-Newhall did his enormous photography show. There's this show of Walker Evans, in which he includes many photographs that he made while he was working for the government. But here, the use of those photographs is radically different. Instead of being embedded in text to keep everything on a coherent governmental message, the photographs were in a book with blank pages opposite them and without captions. The titles were all at the back of the book. So what Evans was striving for here was a kind of photographic language that worked through sequence, one photograph after another, and wanting the viewer to struggle with the meaning of the photograph without being able to rely on the language next to it. Much more of a cinematic form, a kind of montage, and with a much greater burden on the viewer to make meaning of these images. And there is a sense in which it is a never-ending process. And Alan Trachtenberg has argued, who's very important in the history of photography in the United States. He's now retired. He was at Yale for many years. But he argued that Evans was looking for a way to create a moral point of view through photography. And he wanted that point of view to come through the photographs themselves, a way of looking at the world. The photographs he took while working for Stryker are quite extraordinary. This is one he took in 1936 in Alabama, called the Burroughs Family and House in Hale County. And in his own way, Evans secured a kind of Americanness. And in part, he did this through a plainness. Evans felt much more ambivalent about Americanness than Stryker did, right? Stryker was very much of a kind of nationalist bent, not in a sword-rattling way, but just, you know, believing very strongly in the American experiment. Evans was much more skeptical, and the plainness of his photographs, the plainness of the faces, the way in which the faces work off these plain fronts of vernacular American architecture has a great deal of ambiguity. On the one hand, it seems to bear a kind of honesty, a kind of simple honesty, a kind of virtue. But on the other hand, it also seems to call up a kind of repression, a kind of silencing. And this is Allie Mae Burroughs, the matriarch of the Burroughs family, who's in this picture here on the far right and here in a single portrait. A wonderful portrait where her pursed lips seem almost as though she's holding something back. And Evans was remarkable in the way in which he did suggest a certain kind of noble suffering for these individuals, but it was had more dimensions than most of the FSA photographers had, so that the individual seemed to be suffering not just human erosion, but suffering under a certain kind of social restraint. And these photographs are quite remarkable. And when Evans used the commercial sign, he used it in a very different way from most of the FSA photographers. He used it in a way that there always seemed to be too many signs. And the signs seemed to crowd in on each other in a way that called into question what kind of syntax could possibly keep them together. There's also a remarkable repetition in many of these photographs by Evans, not just of signs, but also things. Many of his shop windows or shop fronts, you see apple after apple, package after package. There's a kind of repetition in Evans' work that suggests the extent to which repetition is necessary for signification, that we have to have repetition in order to have meaning. That's how language works. And yet, repetition at a certain point becomes deadening, yeah, to meaning. So, for example, if you say Coca-Cola once, it means nothing. It's gibberish. If you say Coca-Cola 1,000 times, it becomes a brand, it becomes an icon, it becomes... But if you say Coca-Cola 1,000,000,000 times, if you keep saying Coca-Cola endlessly, and this is something Warhol called up, it starts to become senseless, yeah? It starts to have a kind of a deadening effect. And this is something that Evans also played with in his photography. All right, so we've discussed the institutionalization of photography in the 1930s, and we've discussed what is arguably the most important strain of photography in the 1930s, and that is this socially concerned photography, which also had the effect of defining a kind of America. Yeah? So when politicians today talk about the heartland, the real America, right? The first imagery that comes to mind for most Americans is this kind of Depression-era photography, right? So, and this goes into the museum, right? It goes into the Museum of Modern Art, so this is very much a part of the development of photography as art. But the third development that I want to talk about stems more directly from the work we ended with last time with Alfred Stieglitz and his equivalents, yeah? With his notion that there were forms that one could encounter in the natural world that would correspond to inner psychological or emotional states. This was a very powerful precedent in American photography. And in the 1930s and 1940s, certain practitioners continued to explore this possibility. And two of the most important are represented before you. On the left, this is an Edward Weston. This is one of his most famous photographs called Pepper Number 30 of 1930. And on the right is an Ansel Adams Granite of 1933. They were both connected to the Stieglitz Circle in New York City. Weston met Stieglitz and Strand in New York City in 1922 and becomes very inspired by what they're doing. And this is just when Stieglitz is beginning to make his equivalents. And Adams in 1930 gets to know Paul Strand. And Adams and Weston and another photographer named Imogen Cunningham formed a group called F64. And F64 was, you know, very high f-stop, so it was a name which conveyed the fact that they made very detailed, very precise, large format gelatin silver prints. And in their work, there was this continuing effort to find those forms in the natural world that would be particularly evocative. As I discussed with respect to Stieglitz, there was always this possibility of some kind of embodiment lurking behind this abstraction. And that was particularly clear in the case of Weston, where there was something very anthropomorphic about the things he photographed, such as this pepper. And Weston himself hated it when people said that these were anthropomorphic. He denied it. But many people were never convinced, and I include myself among those, right? So here's a Weston where that anthropomorphism and the abstraction of nature seem to be very much in dialogue. This is his nude of 1936. And another, Ansel Adams, Trees and Snow in 1933. The prior Ansel Adams I showed you, the granite, is actually kind of edgy for Adams and reflects his early work. He then becomes a photographer focused more on landscape, and he becomes a very important photographer for the early years of the environmental movement in the United States. Adams becomes a member of the Sierra Club, which is an important early environmental organization. And his photographs come to symbolize a kind of perfect, untouched nature that becomes a kind of ideal, yeah, a kind of lost Eden. And one of the things that's very curious is this kind of photography, such as you see on the right, continues to be made in great quantities in the United States and continues to be on the calendars that these environmental organizations give out. And it's very curious because so much has changed in the understanding of ecology and environmentalism. And there's been, in general, a tendency to reject this kind of representation of nature as something other than the human, right? This kind of Eden. But in photography, at least in the United States, it persists to a great degree. Now, this kind of idealization of natural form and this lingering concern about its anthropomorphism was challenged at the time by a photographer who interests me a great deal, and that is Frederick Sommer. This is Frederick Sommer's Jackrabbit of 1939. Sommer is really an international figure. He's born in Italy, and his family moves to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, when he's young. And he goes to the United States and gets educated, but comes back to Rio to practice. At the time, he's practicing landscape architecture. He comes down with tuberculosis and goes to Switzerland to recuperate. And he passes through Paris for several weeks in 1930, and he becomes acquainted, we can only assume, with surrealism. And then he goes to the United States to live in the American Southwest for his health, and he settles in Prescott, Arizona. He meets Weston. He goes to New York City. He meets Alfred Stieglitz, and he begins to make photographs, but of a very different kind. So, for example, this rabbit is a decomposing rabbit on the desert ground, yeah? A rabbit that has already been flattened out, been made photographic in some sense. So here the luscious anthropomorphism of Weston in his peppers and in his nudes is really spoofed in a way, yeah, critiqued with this deflated rabbit on the desert ground. It's also interesting that Sommer is making these photographs during the Second World War, yeah, where there is quite an idealization of the heroic figure in American photography during the war. You can think of Joe Rosenthal's flag raising on Iwo Jima as that kind of icon of heroism. Sommer also makes in 1939 these photographs of chicken parts, yeah, very much taking apart this notion of the kind of wholesome, natural form, right? Working much more in a kind of surrealist mode. And he also makes these horizonless desert landscapes in the early 1940s. This is Arizona landscape of 1943. The Surrealists love this work. Yeah? There's in the Surrealist publication, reproduced one of these horizonless landscapes. This kind of work baffled photographers such as Ansel Adams, who thought, what's the subject? Why, you know, it's all broken up in these tiny fragments. So you can see that I don't want to give a sense of American photography as monolithic, that there was at this time some very strong conflicts. And here I put together the Weston with the Sommer to give you a sense of the tension between these two visions for what modernism in photography would be. Oh, thank you.